Have a good night. This is a special program from TLV1, Toda la Verdad Primero, from Argentina. We welcome all of you and we thank you to follow this program, which is a very interesting view of how the world works and the way we look at the world. In this program, we got as a co-host, my name is Juan Manuel Suaje Pinto, and my co-host is Adrián Sarbucci, which is an international consultant. Thank you, Adrián.
Thank you for having me with you.
And we're making this because we have a special guest coming from Canada.
We do, indeed.
And it will be a pleasure for me to introduce Paul Fromm. Nice to meet you, Paul. Thank you for being in Buenos Aires.
It's my pleasure. It's my first time.
First time in Argentina.
First time in Argentina. Okay. And I would like to describe that Paul Fromm is a head of the Canadian First Immigration Reform Committee. And he has been involved in a number of free speech cases involving efforts by Zionists and others censors the internet. He's the director of the Canadian Association of Free Expression, and he's like a senior Varela, spoke at the London Forum of London, England in April 11 of last year. He has been battling Canada internet censorship, censors, and supported political prisoners like in the case of Brad Love, Terry Tremaine, Arthur Topfan, and David Irving. Is a Canadian free speech activist and has been done public relations work for Ernest Sundel when he was persecuted. In 1914, Mr. Fromm ran for a mayor of the city of Mississauga, population of 720,000 people, and in his campaign of opposition to immigration, he in disputed case of traffic gridlock and the number of one issue for voters in the city. He also is a director of the website Café Duck NSShot.com. I'm sorry.
Yes.
But this is it, and thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm really excited by the communications setup you have here.
Well, we are delighted to have you here, and I do believe that you've been an activist, very deeply activist in the free press, free speech. Do you find this a great difficulty for Canada? Because we hear from Canada that there is all this free expression and
democracy,
there is no lack of democracy.
Yeah.
How is it that works there?
Well, it seems to me we, maybe perhaps not in Latin America, but in Europe and North America, we're facing two crucial issues: population replacement through mass immigration, mm-hmm. and freedom of speech. If we don't have freedom of speech, we can't even deal with the other issue. So freedom of speech is very much under attack in Canada. All sorts of nations describe themselves as democratic, but they're not. In Germany now, people posting on Facebook criticizing Angela Merkel's decision to let about 800,000 people,
refugees, immigrants.
They are being threatened with loss of their jobs and perhaps even loss of their children. Hmm. I mean, but of course Germany's a democracy, in quotation marks. So Canada has a good reputation. It's always mouthing off about human rights and so on. But in terms of freedom of speech, it's a very much endangered commodity in Canada. We have had human rights legislation, which is a way to punish and silence dissent without actually sending you to jail. And then we have the criminal code, which can send you to jail for willfully promoting hate against privileged groups, race, religion, sex, sexual orientation. But that's not to be confused with Christians or white males. You can say anything horrible about them you want.
It's only for specific minorities.
Specific privileged minorities. Yeah. So, as I understand it, your broadcasts go out over the internet, right?
Yes, exactly.
Well, about 20 years ago, my friends and I became aware of just how powerful the internet was going to be. I'm not a technician, so I have trouble doing much more than turn the computer on.
Our generation, though, yes,
it's generational. I know, but nonetheless, it was obvious that this was going to be our way around the controlled press. What, you know, well, however you want to call it. I think certainly in North America, it's a minority controlled press. There are very few really free outlets, and most of them are very tiny. The internet would be a way around that, and increasingly we could see it be inexpensive. And what with the invention of YouTube, what, less than 10 years ago,
no limit practically.
Now everybody can be in their own. You know, movie producer. A lot of people do silly things, showing themselves dancing or something. But I mean, almost anybody can be a citizen producer now, and that really has the enemies of freedom deeply worried.
Very concerned. They are very concerned. Mm-hmm. And how do you see Canada moving? Public opinion in Canada moving forward on this?
Well. Public opinion in Canada is still quite strongly in favor of free speech, but political correctness has had a lot of effect. When I first got into the free speech area in the early 80s, it would be very common if you said to somebody, well, so-and-so has some pretty strong opinions. They would say something like, well, I may not agree with him, but everybody has a right to their opinion. Nowadays, you don't hear that as much. Now you'll hear things like, well, you don't have the right to offend minorities, or you don't have a right to make hateful statements. And you say, well, what's a hateful statement? Well, basically, it's anything someone else doesn't agree with. So there has been some erosion of public consciousness. We have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is like a constitution, but it's utterly phony. It violates what we believe are our Anglo-Saxon rights, that you have the right to do anything except what's specifically prohibited. Whereas European charters, the state gives you certain rights.
Right,
and exactly. Only those. Well, our socialist prime minister, who was a great admirer of Castro and Mao in the 1980s, Pierre Trudeau, gave us a Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And a lot of Canadians were very enthusiastic because it said we had such freedoms as freedom of speech, freedom of belief, freedom of religion, freedom of the press. Wow, that's great. I mean, even I thought, well, that's good. It's good to have those written down. Mm-hmm. What a lot of people didn't see was... That's section
underlined.
Section B. Section A says you have all the rights in Section B, subject only to such restrictions as are demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. What
does that mean exactly?
Well, the judges have had lots of fun for the last 30-some years. Well, what they've decided was, I mean, no restriction would be justified in a free society. Well, what about a democratic society? Well, if the government passes a law that restricts one of your freedoms, provided it doesn't go too far and provided it has a good intention in mind, it can do it. Well, in other words, you don't have the freedoms. And we have fought these free speech restrictions all the way to the Supreme Court, I think five times. And what the courts have always said is the state has an interest in suppressing hate. Remember the Second World War.
Exactly.
and so if it doesn't go too far, it's all right. So essentially, we don't have free speech, or we have very limited free speech. And one of our greatest free speech lawyer, the late Doug Christie.
Oh, yeah.
He defended Zundel. He defended Keekstra. He even defended me when I was getting myself fired because I'd my political activities had come to the attention of the Zionist lobby, and they decided I ought to be fired. But Christie said, it doesn't matter what's in constitutions or bills of rights or charters of rights. The only rights you really have are those you're prepared to fight for.
Exactly.
You know, so if people...
You can exert.
If people don't really want those freedoms, there's always somebody around to take them away. A lot of my American friends are very complacent. You know, they'll say, "We have the First Amendment." You know, and yes, you do, but it only applies to government. Government may not make laws to restrict free speech, and even there, they sometimes do. But that doesn't mean individuals can't do terrible things. One of your previous guests, Dr. David Duke, has had all sorts of meetings canceled.
Exactly.
A less overtly anti-Zionist group, the American Renaissance, the conference canceled at four different hotels. People were making violent threats against the hotels, and basically the FBI didn't do anything, the police didn't do anything. So yes, they've got the First Amendment, but people can still be, meetings can be stopped and people fired.
Well, rights are really those that you can exercise, otherwise they're just theory. One of the things we say here, because what you're mentioning also happens here in Argentina, is that we always talk about discrimination, and people tend to think, oh, discrimination is when a big group of people are nasty to a tiny little minority because of the color, the religion, the country they come from, their sexual tendency, whatever. But what about, we're saying what's the real problem of a country like Argentina and probably Canada and the world over is when a tiny minority that wields huge power discriminates against the majority. So the question there, and this is probably the real tough question, is which are those minorities in Canada? I mean, I can say very, very openly here, in Argentina you would have, as minorities, people who wield a lot of economic clout, okay, you might say certain bankers, certain corporations, and on a political basis, the local Zionist lobbies. Would that be the same in Canada? Here they wield huge power, horrendous power.
Yes, the Zionist lobby in Canada is responsible for the radical change in our immigration policy. We back in 65, and Kevin MacDonald did the research in his book, A Culture of Critique. And it's not just Canada, it's the same thing in the United States, same thing in Australia. Canada had traditionally a European immigration policy. We're a European country.
Mm-hmm. So are we.
So the Paris of the Southern Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And that was radically changed in 65. There was no public demand for it. And it was changed by because of pressure from the Zionist lobby. At about the same time, there was pressure for hate laws. And from exactly the same source. Canadians weren't in the streets saying, we need hate laws. We want less freedom. We want to be restricted.
Same here.
The Zionist lobby, they'd actually been lobbying since the 30s for these, anti-hate laws. And for many years, it didn't go anywhere. But their strength had increased to the point by the mid-60s that they were able to get a prime minister who appointed a royal commission. Now, what a royal commission does is it allows the politicians to leave the decision to others, and then they can say, well, this is what the commission reported, and they're learned experts. Well, of course, the way you manipulate that is you appoint the right people.
Exactly.
So on a seven-man committee, a royal commission.
Sort of a Warren Commission on
exactly. Two of them were former heads of the Canadian Jewish Congress. Okay. I wonder what they're going to recommend. Well, not surprisingly, they thought we needed a hate law. But it's just an amazing story. And we tried to bring this out at one of the Zundel cases, but we were thwarted. It's more complicated than that. Back in 1965, the instincts for freedom of speech in largely British Canada were still quite strong.
Yeah, that's gone. That's eroded.
So how do you overcome that? Well, they got a Jewish assistant professor of psychology to do a learned paper on the effects of hate propaganda on vulnerable minorities. So he brought forth a paper that said basically, when confronted with hate propaganda, a vulnerable minority first of all feels afraid, then they feel alienated, then they don't want to participate, and then eventually maybe they even hit the booze and the pills.
They're cornered, poor little things, into.
Well, we had the great pleasure at one of these internet hearings to get a modern day psychologist to absolutely destroy that argument. It is, well, this, when we first spoke to this man, Dr. Persinger, he's the present expert. He's an expert in neuropsychology. And with the techniques of neuropsychology, they can actually record the reactions of the brain. Previous science required somebody to tell you how they were feeling. Well, now we know. And that account that the courts bought was just, he when we first talked to him, he said, well, from the 1960s, that was questionable science. By the 1980s, it was poor science. Today, it's
made
junk.
Up. It's junk. It's junk. It's all made up.
Well, the courts bought that. They still buy it. That's why the vulnerable minorities have to be protected from criticism because they're so delicate. They might be alienated and, you know. So that was the second thing they did in bringing in hate law. They dressed it up with the aura of science. And then the final thing they did, which was incredibly clever. In the 1960s, one of the problems for the people wanting hate laws was there wasn't much controversial material out there.
Right.
There wasn't much hate. So what they did is they got a young fellow
to fabricate it.
Yes, this young fellow became the leader of the Canadian Nazi Party. And he was the all-time biggest dupe. And we have this documented. I mean, I think he was almost as big a dupe as Oswald. and he was a well-meaning anti-communist young Canadian. And he was in what we in Canada call social credit circles, you know, economic reform, okay. Etc. So he was in these circles, and the Canadian Jewish Congress sent out kind of spotters. They want to keep an eye on these people, and they saw that this is a young fellow. He wants action. Some of these older economic reformers, they're older men, and they like to talk, but they weren't doing. He wanted to do something. Mm-hmm. So this was at the beginning of the Vietnam War. So he wanted to thought. Well, what he'd do is he would go down to the American consulate and confront these left-wing organizations that were, you know, against the war in Vietnam. That was a good idea, and they said, "Well, what are you going to call yourself?" Well, he said, "I don't know, the British People's League." He's always been pro-British. They said, "Oh no, you won't get any publicity that way. You've got to be a Nazi. If you bring a swastika flag,
everybody will look at you."
Well, you know, when you tell that story today. People say, how could anybody be so stupid? But in the 1960s, we were actually a more tolerant society, 20 years after World War II than we are today. So he fell for it, and they gave him a lot of beer. So he formed the Canadian Nazi Party, which had seven members. Of them, there was himself, an old Dutchman who maybe was legit. Everybody else was either an agent for the Canadian Jewish Congress or Jewish. They even went to a theater supply store and got themselves the uniform.
Nice SA uniform.
Yes,
these two Jewish brothers, they were going to be his bodyguard.
Armbands and everything.
The whole thing. However, at his first big public march, when he arrived at this public rally assembly place, there were 5,000 Jews there to confront him. His bodyguards were nowhere to be seen. He was all by himself. He got about 50 feet into the park, and somebody.
Oops.
Microphone mishap. There we go.
Hit him with a pair of binoculars, knocked him out. He was then arrested for, I guess, assembling without a permit, and so on. But in that heady spring of 1965, every time he said anything, it was front page in the local papers. Beattie says, Beattie will march. Beattie will.
Somebody was setting it up.
And it was beautiful by, I mean, from a sense of manipulation. By the end of the year, of course. the Nazi Party had been destroyed. He'd gone to jail. And so anybody who really was thinking of actually joining would have thought, seen it was not a good idea. But it gave them the pretext. They could say, look, there is a threat. There are Nazis here, and they're not old people from Europe. They're young Canadian-born people. This is terrible. We need a law.
It's a variant of a false flag.
It's absolutely.
It's an intellectual false flag.
Absolutely false flag operation, that's how they got the law. And we've taken it to the Supreme Court a couple of times, and it's been upheld. You were talking about the divide between what the majority of people want and what we get. Our judiciary in Canada is absolutely in the control of the cultural Marxists.
Same here in Argentina. The same government and the judiciary.
We've taken it to the Supreme Court a couple of times. In 1990, when that law went to the Supreme Court, the court voted 5-4 to uphold it. But there were four dissenters, including the woman who's now our Chief Justice. Over the intervening years, the judges have repeatedly been invited to Israel.
Which helps to convince them to do the right thing for them.
You know, if you invited a Supreme Court, if the Prime Minister invited a Supreme Court judge to have a drink with him, this would be considered an outrageous interference.
Yeah, conflict of interest.
Absolutely.
Well, and it happened to us as well, with the Jewish community or the Masons, have been treated to go there to inform, to have a chat or something like that, but they compromise, the final
political candidates.
We
have presidential elections now in a few weeks' time, and all the presidential candidates are invited to Israel. They are invited to speak at the local AIPAC here, which is the DAIA, the delegation of Israeli associations in Argentina. You have the same pattern, same model being repeated over and over. We were speaking before the program about Alberto Nisman, who is this public prosecutor that was committed suicide or was suicided by somebody earlier this year. He was allegedly investigating, trying to pin on Iran as being the culprit for blowing up the headquarters of the local AMIA Jewish Mutual Association. And he went so far that whilst he spent 10 years investigating, he could find no proof whatsoever against Iran, but he went at one point to inform how things were going to the Supreme Court of Israel. He wouldn't even do it here. He went to the Supreme Court in Tel Aviv. I mean, it's incredible the way they are so subservient, and yet, the local media will just not carry it, or they will distort it, or they will hide it. And the problem is that people don't realize what is actually happening, which is one small question.
And that's never made the North American press.
Oh, no.
No.
Well, we together with Jim Fetzer from the Architects for 911, we put together an interview to show that this case had actually even existed, because people didn't know that in 1994 there was an attack against the Jewish Mutual Association headquarters, and that it was probably internal fighting among Zionists, because the whole thing came to a head 1 year later when they assassinated Prime Minister Rabin, who wanted to reach some sort of a deal, peace for territory with the Palestinians. After that was in November 1995, Rabin was swept from power, and you had all these ultra-right-wing Zionists taking over until the nut who sits now in the Israeli government, Mr. Netanyahu. But the question I wanted to ask you is, when what you describe about Canada sounds so much with what is happening in Argentina, with what is happening in Chile, definitely what's happening in Germany. What do you feel Zionists get out of this? But what is their, because it's become so obvious. We just had Netanyahu saying in the UN, the world is staying silent to what's happening, all the threats against Israel, and the UN literally looked at him in silence. So, I mean, are they overdoing it? Is the pendulum gone so far to one side it's going to start coming the other way around? Because I think if I were an Israeli, I would feel very, very insecure about what's happening, in world public opinion.
You're going to answer that right after this break. We will be right back.
Very interesting what you mentioned about it.
Well, we are back with Paul Front and Adrian Sarbucci, and there was a question on the table, you know. And
yes, I think the question was, what's their game?
What's their game, exactly?
Well, some people say world control. Certainly, though, it is to line up as much of the world, that'd be Europe and the Americas, in support of Israel, which I think is an untenable proposition, even if you're in favor of it. It is led the United States, and certainly I think spear carriers like Canada, in the wrong direction in our relationships with much of the rest of the world. Our prime minister prides himself as being 110% Israel first, or he says, Israel's values are Canada's values. And I thought, geez, I wish that were true, because Israel has a restrictive immigration policy.
Absolutely.
Oh, wait a second, maybe he didn't mean that. He said, Canada stands behind Israel as a Jewish state. I thought, wouldn't it be nice if he would stand behind Canada as a European country? Oh, no, we're supposed to be diverse. well, actually, it's not funny, but...
Do as I say, not as I do.
Yes. Yeah. I think the long-range goal, though, is significant world power, and what's going on now in the European Union is terrifying. We see a wholesale invasion. A population change, a political class that is completely either inept or collaborating. There are dissenters like the Front National and the UKIP and so on. But to his great credit, the president of Hungary.
But yes.
But the main political establishment, particularly in Germany, as far as I can tell, in France. And Austria, they're either helpless in the face of this invasion, or they collaborate with it, because there's a long range goal to break up Europe so that it will no longer be European, and that goes back actually to before the founding of the common market.
Right. Do you think that there is any devious action on the part of the United States, for example, in trying to channel this refugee problem targeting Europe? Let me give you an example. We said in a program with my colleague, Enrique Romero, a few weeks back, a bit tongue-in-cheek, since we have an Argentinian pope and we have such a vast land in Argentina, why don't we bring these refugees to Argentina, which is a melting pot of different people from Europe, and we have a sizable Syrian Lebanese population here and so forth, and obviously they're not going to come in, we're like something like 10,000 miles away, but in Europe they are literally walking from Syria into Europe. Is somebody channeling that? Is somebody forcing that? And it's really endorsed the problem against Hungary, Austria, Germany, Spain, Italy, horrendous, it's insoluble. And one of the things that we see from here is this whole situation was created by the European Union, by NATO, by the United States, and by Britain. I mean, when all the dying and the bloodshed was happening in the 6 o'clock news, they said, well, okay, so we killed 1.5 million Iraqis, and we murdered 500,000 Libyans, and half the population of Syria is displaced, but what the hell, you know, we live here, it doesn't come here. Now that it's on your doorstep, you know, what do you do about it? And that's when you see that Europe's leadership have no reply whatsoever.
I think there's an answer to that on two levels. Certainly the brainless meddling on behalf of Israel in Iraq, Syria, and Libya has helped create this movement of people. I'm not sure in the context, but about 10 years ago, Colonel Gaddafi made a speech in which he said, if it were not for me, I could unleash millions of Africans on Europe.
He said
now,
that.
I don't know if this was a threat or just a statement, but under Gaddafi, there were no boats crossing the Mediterranean.
Right.
Well, Canada was a part of it. Canada, the United States, Britain, France, Italy, I guess, decided that we would assist with regime change. Well, he got rid of Gaddafi, he got murdered, and what took his place? Complete chaos.
Civil
and now
war.
the boats are pouring across the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. Well, didn't seem like a very good move. I think the intervention in Iraq has been universally discredited. Saddam Hussein may not have been everybody's idea of a Democrat, but
certainly better what they have now.
Better than, and the Christians were not persecuted, and he managed to keep the various factions relatively stable. The same in Syria. Bashar al-Assad protects the Christian minority. I would have thought the plight of Christians would be of some interest to Western leadership, especially to the Canadian Prime Minister, who claims he's an evangelical Christian. You would think that protecting these folks would be on the agenda.
Yeah.
Instead, we assist in the attacks on these on Iraq, and that was successful, overthrew Saddam Hussein, and now there's chaos in Syria. They've not succeeded in overthrowing al-Assad, and there's chaos.
But
and
President Obama has just said Bashar al-Assad must go. I mean, how can one president say the president of another country must go? I mean,
what elected gives him, democratic.
What gives him the moral authority to even utter such a thing?
It's outrageous. And, you know, I think it violates the world's sense of fair play. I'm not a fan of nuclear weapons and so on.
Nobody is either.
I would agree, yes, nuclear weapons are not a good thing. But for a country a group of countries to say Iran cannot have nuclear weapons,
and I can,
won't be allowed.
and Israel can.
Well, Israel, its mortal enemy, just a few hundred miles away, has, and it's surrounded by nuclear powers. It's got Pakistan on the east, beyond that, India. North of it, China and Russia. They're not necessarily all hostile, but they're all nuclear powers. And Iraq, although it doesn't have its own nuclear weapons, it has the American nuclear umbrella. I think a leader of Iran would be foolish not to at least consider nuclear weapons.
Absolutely.
And to say that they cannot have them, I think ultimately it violates people's sense of fairness. And, you know, I think it would be perfectly legitimate to say to Iran, don't you ever dare use them on Europe or North America. Notice what I did not say.
Exactly.
Nuclear
weapons are dissuasive.
Or will punish. But to say you can't have them, sure.
Who are you to tell me what I can or cannot do?
Even if it is an internal development for some technology, like for example in energy or whatever, being needed today, and nuclear sense of development is essential for the energy production.
Yeah. We have nuclear reactors in this country. We built by us. If anything, we should have had, I know people are going to hate me for saying this, we should have had a military nuclear program as dissuasion. Because had we had a militarized nuclear program when we had the war over the Falkland Maldina Islands with Britain, maybe Britain wouldn't have come down here so rashly. They are dissuasive. Who would dare invade California or invade Vladivostok or invade Peking? You just don't do that because you know that these people have a lot of clout. What about Argentina? We can be run over and nobody gives a
I think that's an interesting point. You asked what is behind this movement. Well, what I've just answered, I think, is fairly clear. There is repeated chatter, though, on the internet that there's big money. Now, I read individual interviews with some of these illegals, and they've got a lot of money. One man was very unhappy. He spent a lot of money. He was in Turkey. He bought a dinghy, and some Turkish soldier had taken a bayonet and disabled the dinghy, and he said that he'd lost his last $3,400. I thought, how many people in North America have $3,400 hanging around in their back pocket? and you look at these people that are coming across, fighting with the Hungarian police. They're well-built, good-looking young men. They don't look like bedraggled refugees. They're well-built. They're all chattering on their cell phones.
It's infiltration.
There's money behind this. Some people say it's George Soros. Some people say it's the CIA, but they're clear, or some people say it's Saudi Arabia, but there certainly is some, this is a planned operation.
Mm. It's engineered.
And the target's Europe.
What is the objective, what they have? Is just for the world control, or for the new world order, or is there something else, like the multiculturalism, for example, or the vanish of different races, like the white or plank allergy, no?
I think that's...
Is there anything
I think that's
farther than that?
I think in terms of Europe, that's the goal, to replace the Europeans with a multicultural population. Mm. And as the Hungarian president has said, to essentially replace Christians with... Mm. With non-Christians, and that's why, I know it's probably not very diplomatic of me being in Argentina, but I'm most disappointed with the Argentinian Pope.
Oh, yes, we all are, don't worry.
His remarks in this crisis, as a Catholic leader, he has to realize that Europe was invaded at least four times in the past 1,000 years. As recently as about 1750, the Muslims were at the gates of Vienna.
Exactly.
Now that's part of our culture. And to say that every Catholic parish
should open Italy, its doors.
Well,
to
this is.
We are also disappointed.
Disappointed is perhaps the nicest term for it.
Today, Russia is playing like a key role in the world table. What do you think about it? What is Russia playing today? With this also resigning into the unique thinking and resisting to all this new age that is going on in Europe, with the influence of all this immigration, plus the United States pressure on different countries. What do you think Russia's position today is?
Yeah, I think that's Russia is a very interesting, playing a very interesting role, especially now with its assistance in Syria to the Assad government. Mm. Russia historically considered itself the protector of the Christians in the Middle East. That role is clearly not being fulfilled by the United States, France, and Russia, and Britain. I think that's part of it. I think Assad. Putin may well be able to bring about some sort of maybe not exactly peace, but some solution to this
pacification.
Unending conflict. I think his intervention is critical and very welcome.
It's been quite forceful, and it took the West by surprise. Mm. You see, just the Russian attaché in Baghdad went over to see the American attaché and said, if you have anything flying over Syria, bring it out because we're going to bomb in an hour, and if you have any assets on the ground, take them out because we're going to start bombing. Mm. And I think Obama was very surprised at how fast it went. And they have a naval base there, and they have aircraft, and you also have a Chinese aircraft carrier that went through the Suez Canal and is now also in the Mediterranean, and the Chinese jets are coming in to populate that aircraft carrier. So we might be seeing something very big happening unless the West stands down, and the question is, can they? Mm. And if they do, will Israel stand down? Will Saudi Arabia stand down? Because maybe France, Britain, and America might stand down, but will Israel and Saudi Arabia stand down?
That's a very good question. And one of the things I find very interesting is that ISIS or ISIL wants to set up this caliphate, and they're killing other Muslims who don't
Christians. Yeah.
Christians, these Yazidis who are kind of, I think, Zoroastrian, but they're not Muslims. But what I don't see them, with all their militants and their...
Attacking Israel.
They're not attacking Israel.
That's the same thing we say.
This is
surprising.
This is remarkable.
Seems like they're trying to make all this propaganda in pulling the Christians against the Arabs. See,
well,
generate this religious war, and where one of the main components is Israel, no? The Judaism or the Zionism.
Yeah.
Are they playing a key role in that?
Well, I think it's it makes you wonder what is really going on with ISIS or ISIL.
Who are they?
Had this man named al-Baghdadi apparently was trained by the Mossad. Yes. Well, how does this fit?
Financed by the CIA as well.
Yes. And one explanation, though, is if large Arab nations like Syria and Iraq can be broken up into smaller units by the caliphate, neither of these nations can pose a threat to Israel, and the caliphate has no air force and no navy. A divided Arab world is a safer, makes a safer world
divided
for Israel. That's one theory I've seen floated, and it does seem to make sense.
Yeah, we mentioned on our program here on Channel TLV1 a couple of months back that you had America giving the Iraqi government 2,300 Humvees worth something like $600 million. The Iraqi government parks them in Mosul, in Iraq, and immediately they lose Mosul to ISIS, and ISIS take over these brand new 2,300 Humvees. And you figure, well, that's a nice way of transferring technology and military material to ISIS.
Whoops.
Oh dear, we lost them.
Yeah, we lost them. What a pity.
So is this just incompetence, as often happens in the military? Or was this deliberate?
That's the question.
Sounds more deliberate than
yeah.
You know, at least they deliver it.
They deliver it.
I'm going to say something because even American military can't be that stupid.
They
right?
find a way to deliver it. Now, for example, there is like a growing up in Europe, also with the immigration and everything like that is going on, especially economically as well. There is like a rise of a new right wing.
Yes.
Seems like a new style of the right wing. How do you see it? How do you see that, something that is going to bring up to the glory of Europe, that it will save Europe? Maybe it will be a wave that it will hit America. I mean, all America, not the United States, but Canada as well, in South America. Do you think this is going to make some change, or is going to be a quicker confrontation?
Yes, I think there are some hopeful signs. The anti-immigration or nationalistic party in Denmark essentially has active control. Control of the coalition. The Front National looks very prone, very likely to possibly win the next election, the elections. There are very good parties in Italy,
mm-hmm. Greece,
and I think that there's I guess in North American terms we might call it a populist movement, but it's not strictly the old left-right paradigm of the parties on the right being simply for big business and money. Parties on the left, more for
trade unions or
social welfare. Yeah. I think Marine Le Pen has helped bridge that gap to some extent in France, I think that's the same pattern in some of the other countries. You mentioned the role of big businesses, mm-hmm. and they tend overwhelmingly to be hostile to the interests of the European people. In North America, some of the biggest backers in the United States of massive illegal immigration are big corporations. Mm. They want cheap labor. They don't care who they are or what they are. If it's cheap, they're happy.
If they destroy the social fabric, collateral damage.
Who cares? We live in our gated communities, and exactly. we imagine we'll be safe forever. In Canada, I mentioned that our judiciary is in the control of cultural Marxists, and I say that very deliberately. I've studied the Frankfurt School at great length, lectured on in the United States and Europe, and a particularly evil and influential group of people, and they have absolutely captured whole swaths of academia. Our Supreme Court not long ago upheld a law that punished a Christian preacher who had handed out material that was was critical of homosexuality. And there was relatively mild stuff. He had two stick figures, a man holding hands and a circle and a slash across it, and then a couple of the scriptures from Leviticus.
Yeah, well, his ideas, yeah, he was just voicing his ideas.
Well,
that's not allowed in Canada.
That was material that was likely to promote hatred or contempt against a vulnerable minority. And even though the homosexual lobby has won everything that's wanted in Canada, we now have same-sex marriage, you know.
Same here.
The Supreme
has been approved already?
Oh, yes, the Supreme Court said. Uh-huh. So, you know, a man can marry a woman, a man can marry a man, a woman can marry a woman, a man can marry a goat.
Exactly.
Anything goes.
And in America, the same thing. Supreme Court in July also said it's legal in all 50 states.
But the interesting thing is that that in this court decision, it was decided that this was the homosexuals and the transgendered and the ungendered and whatever were a vulnerable minority. They're not vulnerable. They have everything their own way. The vulnerable minority is that group you talked about near the beginning. It's the majority. Yeah. Christians exactly. Now have to be very careful
what you say, how you say it, etc. And definitely.
And I'm sad to say that the Catholic Church has been a complete disaster. In Canada, they had the numbers to stop abortion on demand, which we have now, and the homosexual agenda. But the church did almost nothing. Maybe a little bit of mumbling, but they never read the Riot Act to
cosmetics only.
No.
Cosmetics. Let me ask you. I know time is. Sure. We don't have that much time. You mentioned before we spoke in the program that there will be a hearing regarding Arthur Topham.
Yes.
And that you are personally also involved in that hearing. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, Arthur Topham has a website which is well worth people looking at. It called Radical Press, all one word, .com, radicalpress.com. And Arthur has since about 2007 taken a real interest in Zionism and what he sees as Zionist control of many institutions in Canada and elsewhere. And almost as soon as he made that move, he was persecuted by the man who was a major force with B'nai B'rith in Western Canada, a man named Harry Abrams. That was under an old human rights law, which we eventually got repealed. So that case died, but almost immediately, Abrams went after Arthur Topham under the hate law of the criminal code. And that case will be heard at the beginning on the 26th of October in a small town in rural British Columbia. The government is very annoyed that Arthur created links to books like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and a particularly evil, hateful book called Germany Must Perish, which was written by a man named Kaufman in 1941. And it really is a blueprint for genocide.
That's hate literature.
That is hate literature. Now, what Topham did is he showed that, and then he rewrote the first couple of chapters, even the cover, so where it says Germany must perish, it's Israel must perish. And the first couple of chapters, wherever it says Germany, it's Israel, wherever it says Germans, it's Jews.
Trade of the names. Yeah.
What he was doing, but the police are so stupid that they don't understand this, is a parody.
To show how that was definitely hate literature.
Yes. Yeah. This is going to be one interesting case. We're talking about this as being the equivalent of the monkey trial in Tennessee.
Sure. Darwinism and everything.
We're hoping to make complete fools of the police. That's what we hope. At the preliminary hearing, Arthur was asking the credentials of the hate squad police, and there was one woman. She was one of the investigators, and he was trying to get her to find out if she even knew what a parody was. And it's not quite sure. Well, he asked her, "Well, what are your academic credentials?" She said she'd been to college for dental. Well, he was smart enough to pursue that. She was a dental hygienist, and then she became a policeman. Well, I don't mock anybody's profession, but I'm not sure.
Those are the proper credentials.
Scrubbing
you want to
teeth
see.
gives you a background in literature.
Absolutely.
Anyway,
absolutely.
I think. Well, trials are never fun, and I probably shouldn't say we're going to have fun. But Arthur's a real fighter, mm-hmm. and this is going to be a fight that we really want to win, and we want to put the law on trial.
Right.
How can a free country have laws that restrict nonviolent speech? We're not talking about going out in the street and telling somebody to go and kill somebody.
Voicing your ideas. That's all. Right.
He's got opinions.
Yeah, opinions. And, exactly.
He's got opinions on a book called The Protocols. Well, isn't he entitled to an opinion?
Exactly.
Is it the same like Ernest Sundel went through? There is some kind of similarity?
The similarity, except Ernst initially in two trials in 84 and 88 was prosecuted under a law called false news. Mm-hmm. Now, he eventually got that law turned... nullified, well, actually ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. because there was an old law that from the 19th century that really dealt with financial misinformation. In the days, for instance, before telegraph and so on, if you were to say put out in the papers in Canada that there was a glut of wheat in Britain, you could get the wheat farmers to maybe sell their wheat very, very cheap. In fact, there was no plot. Yeah. So that was what it was intended, it was aimed at. It was never aimed for at questions of history. So Ernst Sundel put out a booklet called Did 6 Million Really Die? He didn't write it. It was written by an Englishman, but he published it and mass distributed it. And that caused a huge kerfuffle. Did 6 Million Die is... perhaps limited in terms of when considering today's studies on the on the events of World War II, mm-hmm. But it made some good points
at the time. Yeah.
At the time, sure. And what Sundel did is he brought in a lot of experts, mm-hmm. and I think it's a trial they wish they hadn't had. Mm-hmm. The first one got a lot of publicity. In fact, one of the great experts, I'm pretty sure it was Raoul Hilberg, but I might be wrong, he said he was in Auschwitz, and he could tell the nationality of the person being cremated by the color of the smoke. Now, that sounds like almost like a dirty joke.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
human bodies are... they're all...
It's gross.
The smoke is all, I don't know, black, white. I mean, it isn't green.
But depending on your nationality, it's the color of the smoke. That's ridiculous.
This was actually reported as a headline in one of our major papers, and it made them look ridiculous.
Yeah.
By the second trial, the word had gone out to the media, and there was almost no publicity. Even though the second trial had some very impressive experts. Sundel commissioned a man by the name of Fred Leuchter.
Oh yeah, the Leuchter Report.
To go to the detention camp at Auschwitz.
He was an expert. He actually built ovens gas chambers, for gas chambers.
Yes, he actually built death machines. He's one of those people with a very
America.
Rare expertise. But that testimony was
devastating.
Even though that Sundel in that way made it up, he had to sign something like not to talk about again about the 6 million or gas chambers or anything related to the Holocaust.
Leuchter or Sundel?
Sundel. Is it like that?
I don't. Unless maybe in Germany, but not in Canada. In the end, he was convicted, but the conviction was appealed to the Supreme Court, and the law was thrown out.
Okay.
As you know, then Sundel got the next attack on Sundel. By this time, we're in the mid 90s, and there's a website called the Sundel site. Mm-hmm. So they went after him under a human rights law, and we initially had a big battle as to whether the internet was actually telephonic communication. And then they changed the law. So that to fight terrorism, it was decided it was telephonic communication. And when they changed the law to give the Human Rights Commission control over the internet, the former president of the Canadian Jewish Congress, he was a lawyer from Quebec. He said that we needed control of the internet to fight terrorism. And I thought there'd been all sorts of explanations of 9/11, but one I never heard of was that there was computers flying at the World Trade Center.
Shaped like airplanes.
So it really had nothing to do with fighting terrorism.
Arbitrary.
It was thought control.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we eventually got that law repealed by Parliament in 2012. It took 10 years, a lot of damaged lives, and of all the people ever complained about for putting out information on the internet likely to expose a privileged group to hatred or contempt, not a single Muslim or Islamic group was ever complained about. It was always economic reformers, conspiracy theorists, immigration opponents, people who have problems with the Hollywood version of World War II. Those people never had anything to do with terrorism.
Exactly.
Never had anything.
Exactly.
Well, I think we reached the end of this interview.
Conversation indeed.
And Paul Fromm, thank you very much for sharing this program with us.
And thank you for giving me a really good welcome to Argentina.
This is a
pleasure to have you with us.
This is a friends chat, so it has been
exactly.
Greatly. And thank you for the work you do, the work you have done,
and the efforts.
We share, friendship with many of the people we mentioned already. And I hope you have a good stay in Buenos Aires.
Thank you.
And I look in the future just to keep in touch and maybe to keep on interviewing through Skype or something like that.
Yes, that'd be good.
Now the internet makes it easy.
We have to travel to Buenos Aires or either we to Canada in order to keep in touch.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Adrian, thank you so much.
Thank
and
you,
if you want to give a few words to close up this program.
Yes, I think it might be an idea. Basically, after talking to Paul, we can see that it's the same model in Canada, in Argentina, in Brazil, in Germany. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, one has to ask who has the clout globally to impose their viewpoint, to impose their laws, to slush around their money to make sure that journalists and everybody toes the line. It's very, very concerning, I think, that such a small, tiny group of individuals can exert so much power over the vast majority of us. And I think it's at least, and I think you probably will agree with us in this, Paul, it's a matter of concern that the majority of mankind should be held at ransom by such a small minority. So, we have to understand what it's all about and then do the right thing. Because if people do not understand what is really happening, then there will always be some people who might do the wrong thing, react incorrectly, really be arbitrarily against some of these smaller groups, the Zionists, for example, who are giving the Jewish communities a bad name in many countries. They certainly are in Argentina. So the more people understand, the more people hear the different the different viewpoints, the better it will be for everybody. And I think it's probably in the Jewish community's own interest, and I think the Jewish community in Argentina is understanding that, to take some distance away from the Zionist movement and start that we should all behave as we do in Argentina and as we do in Canada as responsible citizens, all living together with our differences, our original immigration from different parts of Europe or in Argentina from parts of the Middle East, from China. We have a sizable Chinese community here, a sizable community of people who are the original inhabitants of the American continent, and just live together and do things correctly.
That's why TLB1 is for, huh?
Yes, sir.
To awaken in minds and to clear up and have a clear view of what's going on.
Yes, sir, indeed.
Thank you so much, Adrian.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much for you, all of you, for being with us, and we hope we meet again in another special of TLB1 here from Buenos Aires, Argentina. Gracias. Bye-bye.